Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Aparuta de sangamatasa tavara ye sorvanta bamunchantu satang. So this evening, we have, this is the posata, and the following this tradition, the lunar calendar, winter's retreat, and certainly appreciate the fact that you're month of January, where I couldn't be here, and everything seems to be going well. It's nice to know that I'm expendable. It's easy to think that the world will fall apart if I don't control it. But that's not the way things are. And so I had this opportunity to go to Thailand and Malaysia, and I do enjoy both of those countries. Asia is like a kind of, I always feel very much at home in Asian countries. And so having, I was in the Peace Corps in 1963, just when it was really beginning. And I was in Peace Corps training when President Kennedy was assassinated, November of 63. And so that was a big shock, because I was very much inspired by President Kennedy in those days, and the idea of going to an Asian country to work, the idea was to provide what they called middle level manpower, which was the idea of filling in where jobs where the people didn't have the personnel to do so. So of course English, teaching English was, I was an English teacher in Malaysia. I was assigned to Sabah and Sarawak, which is now called Eastern Malaysia. And there, the two British, were British colonies on the island of Borneo. And I was there for 2 years in a very paradisical place called Semporna. And then after that, went to Thailand and became a monk. Hadn't been back for 42 years or so, and 43 years. And of course, always had these very pleasant memories of my life in this tropical paradise. And like most memories of the past, the realities of daily life are not present. You remember usually the more pleasant aspects. And what I always remembered was how beautiful it was, and had a pleasant enough job teaching English in a primary school, Chinese school, and pleasant company. But still, in spite of all the pleasing aspects of this idyllic life I was leading, I still suffered a lot because of just the negative thought habits that I'd acquired. And I had my 30th birthday in Semporna. So the word Semporna is actually from the Sanskrit Semporna, which means perfection. I thought that was interesting, to live in a place called perfection. And then the imperfection was really my mind, as I grasped these negative thoughts, the critical mind. And the critical mind, of course, is one that is it can go outward towards others, like picking up on what you don't like and criticizing everything. But my tendency was to direct this criticism inwards. So I was kind of stuck with this habit, thinking habit, of criticizing myself. And so every little thing, every mistake I ever made or thought I made or whatever would become exaggerated in with these critical thoughts. So there was a lot of self-loathing, disparagement. And this was not due to anyone's fault, it was just, I realized it was a habit of mind. Maybe a character tendency or vipaka kamma or whatever. So even in paradise, I could create a hell realm due to just my own thinking. So what can you do when you're 30 years old? On my 30th birthday, I realized my youth was gone, really. or going very fast. And 30 more years of living in this with this mindset, with this critical mind, was appalling to me, the idea of having to spend 30 more years. I didn't know what to do about it, you know, how to get out of this habit. And so the one thing that really inspired me at this time, the only thing I had in my life that gave me any hope or any inspiration was Buddhism. And so I followed this, living in Southeast Asia, you're in the Theravadan world. And I knew nothing about Theravada before that. I'd been mainly interested in Zen Buddhism as we kind of picked it up through the California translations of Japanese Zen texts. And so I'd had that kind of introduction for many years towards Buddhism, but Theravada I knew nothing about. So I had the opportunity, living in Sabah, to go to a country like Thailand, which was, you know, easy to get to from there, and which is a Theravadan country. And of course, when I, after 2 years, it was a two-year contract, I went straight off to Thailand, started meditating, became a Samanera in 1966. 1967 became a bhikkhu, took the higher ordination, and that's when I met the Lungpa Cha. So I went to Malaysia with two friends from this Peace Corps time. One was Bob Schmidt, who we trained together in the same training group in Hawaii, and then the following year Donna came, and she was assigned to the same town of Semporna as I was. So Donna and Bob have both become Buddhists, interested in Buddhism, and so we all decided we'd go together back to Sabah just to see what it was like, because I had never returned, never been back to the place. And Ajahn Panyasaro invited him to join us. So there were the four of us. We flew, Ajahn Panyasaro and I went to Thailand for a few days and then to Kuala Lumpur. Back in 1966, in Kuala Lumpur, I remember visiting there before I ordained in the capital of Malaysia. And the Chinese element in Sabah and in Malaya at that time were mainly like traditional Chinese interpretations of Buddhism mixed with culture and Taoism and whatnot. So I was not particularly inspired by the Chinese Buddhism I saw in Malaysia. But this time when we went to Kuala Lumpur, we stayed with Chinese lay men who and he invited his friends, family, both evenings we were there, and has tremendous interest in Theravada Buddhism, which was very pleasing to see. And so in Malaya, in the country of Malaya itself, there's a noticeable interest, increasing interest in Theravada Buddhism among the Chinese Malaysians. And they're interested in meditation. They oftentimes invite monks from Thailand, from the forest tradition, Ajahn Mun tradition, to visit. And so that was inspiring to see this growth and interest in Malaya itself. And then we flew to Kota Kinabalu, which is the capital city of Sabah state, which was previously known as North Borneo. And when I lived there, it was called Jethelton. It had a nice English name. And they've changed it to Kota Kinabalu. And it's in a very beautiful area, naturally beautiful with a harbor. But in 1964, when I first went there, it was a bit of a dumpy city. It had been completely destroyed in the Second World War and rebuilt. But it had no kind of inspiring buildings or parks in it. But this time, when going there, I was quite impressed by the attractiveness, the beauty of Kota Kinabalu. So you see the material progress of this state that I lived in 44 years ago, when it had just been released from the British Colonial Office into the Federation of Malaysia. And so when I lived there, it was still like a colonial country. All the British civil servants were still there, operating there the 2 years that I lived there. And now, of course, it's materially progressed with roads and modernity. Not to the level of Malaya itself, but certainly considerably changed from what I remember 40 years ago. So Borneo was it had never been affected by the Ice Age, you see. So it was famous for its tropical forests, jungles, and that, where they always had all kind of unusual plant life and bird life, insect life, animal life, that had probably been before, you know, from the previous, before the Ice Age. And so there are a lot of species, a lot of life in Borneo that that you wouldn't find anywhere else. And so it was rather sad to see that modernity has, as they've cut down the jungles and planted oil palm tree plantations everywhere. So we drove from Kota Kinabalu up through to the famous mountain Kinabalu, which is the highest mountain in Southeast Asia. And I climbed this mountain years ago before I became a monk. And it's not a volcanic mountain. It's like a huge rock of jagged appearance. It has a very kind of like shark's teeth top. And it's very kind of impressive looking mountain. So we went there, but this time I had no desire to climb it. And neither did the others. I don't know about Ajahn Panyasaro, but he was the young one. But the three oldies, we just liked looking at it. So that was an interesting change, because usually I used to be the kind that as soon as I see something like that, I want to climb up. But I had no inclination of that order. Now, Sabah is naturally quite beautiful state, and a lot of resources and beaches and mountains and whatnot. So we drove all the way to Semporna, which, when I lived there before, there was no road. You could only get to this little port on the east coast of Sabah by steamship. They used to have this British steamship service from Singapore, so you could board the steamship in Singapore and then sail to Kuching and in Sarawak and then Miri and then what was known as Jesselton, now Kota Kinabalu, up around the coast of Borneo to the other side, going toward the east coast to Sandakan and then to Semporna, which was always very pleasant because these British steamships were very pleasant way to travel. And took, you know, a week to get there. But now the road they cut through the jungle goes, you can drive, you know, to Semporna from Kota Kinabalu. So it was quite, it's also the rainy season there. So yeah, but generally we had very good weather. Going to Semporna then was, you could see, you know, it had changed, become more like a resort. It has these islands off the coast. They're famous for scuba diving, and Sipidan is quite world famous now, the island that is especially beautiful near Semporna. So Semporna has become a kind of place where people go from to scuba dive. And they have a 5-star hotel there and a Kentucky Fried Chicken restaurant. And they and the place has grown considerably from what it was when I lived there. So you see the change, progress, material progress. And yet in some ways I'm glad I lived there 40 years ago. I could see it when it was still fairly primitive and not too badly damaged by modernity. I also felt a kind of tawdriness of the whole scene, you know, the meaninglessness of tourism and just life in general, of people living their lives, making money, and the material progress, and then the problems, social problems, immigration problems. They have people coming in from Philippines and Indonesia trying to settle in Sabah. And so you hear the same complaints about illegal entry and unlawful entry and immigration and whatnot, of this movement of human beings that is inevitable, you know, ever since, you know, you read the study the history of Europe, and it's all about migration. One tribe, one group migrating and overpowering another group. So where does it all end? You know, what is the purpose of human life, and what does it have any meaning? And is this material progress the summum bonum of this planetary experience? So we each have our own Mercedes-Benz and laptop computer. And this is a story of success. But also they have built a beautiful mosque in Semporna, and they've also built a Chinese temple, which didn't exist. Very nice, very beautiful temple. But still, when I was there before, when I was young, I found everything exotic and new and interesting. So even the poverty or that fascinated me. I loved going to the kampongs and the villages and just kind of mingling with the people. But this time I noticed that I didn't have such an interest. It just seemed slightly kind of dilapidated and dirty and rather boring, actually. Just the modern progress as it's affected this little town. I used to have dreams when I was there of wanting to stay there, didn't want to leave. But after going back to Semporna, I was glad I left. It's interesting because when I always like these beaches and seaside. So when I went to Thailand in 1966, I had this idea of becoming a monk and living by the seaside, because Thailand has beautiful beaches and whatnot. That's, of course, very famous now for tourism. But the irony of it, the more I tried to manipulate my life so I could end up on a beach with a palm tree in a monk's robe, I ended up in northeast Thailand, which is not particularly beautiful. Living there for 10 years in Ubon Ratchathani. There the forests were a bit scrubby, and there were no kind of majestic mountains or beautiful islands to go scuba diving. There was only a kind of flat plains, rice fields, and scrubby forests. And yet, strangely enough, it was in Ubon that I actually came to terms with this habit of self-criticism. I can see, Ubon became the place more of a paradise for me than Semporna, because it was living in this forest monastery in northeast Thailand that actually penetrated the causes of suffering, could see what I was doing and how to release myself from this habit, how to resolve these mental habits, emotional habits. And of course, it wasn't about material progress, because even now, and like when I remember first going to Wat Pa Phong, Ajahn Chah's monastery, it was very basic kind of place, with no luxuries whatsoever, just no electricity, and everything was, we had to draw water from wells, and there was no kind of middle-class luxuries whatsoever. And of course, I'm from a kind of middle-class background where you take electricity and certain things for granted. But living in the forest monastery in Ubon, I found I didn't really mind, the lack of the luxury or the primitive lifestyle. Because the real emphasis was on the mind and learning how, really examining, investigating consciousness, the reality of consciousness, not just trying to improve the material world around myself, or trying to seek a better place. If I compared Ubon with Semporna, I could, I'd like to live by, Sipidan Island, beautiful island, the sea, coral reefs and palm trees and white sand beaches, and sounds like paradise. But instead, the real change, the real release came not through seeking external paradise, but changing the studying, investigating my own conscious experience of life while living within that context of the Thai forest monastery. So that was a real challenge, because coming from a background which was very kind of hedonistic, where in the California scene of my generation was definitely, to seek pleasure and happiness and do what you want and say what you felt and emphasize how important you are to demand rights and to self-expression, freedom of expression, and all the liberal attitudes that are so common to the West Coast of the United States. Going into a very traditional, conservative Asian Theravadan monastery in a rather remote part of Thailand. So there, of course, the emphasis was on mindfulness. Lungpa Cha the encouragement that I received from him to really observe myself, to observe what suffering is and the causes of suffering. So this of course, I really am grateful for, having such an encouragement opportunity to witness, to see for myself the dukkha, the suffering, the causes of suffering, the cessation of suffering in the way of non-suffering, or the Four Noble Truths. Now, that teaching of the Four Noble Truths has been the kind of main interest of my life, penetrating those Noble Truths. And because I find that is probably the most clear and precise teaching for awakening and seeing and knowing, for enlightenment, for seeing things as they are, for knowing the truth, rather than just, you know, trying to develop a religious life from spiritual ideals or hopes or aspirations. At the beginning, of course, religion was for me kind of inspiring, and I wanted inspiration, and I had aspirations, this sense of always trying to find something I don't have, or to want to have that feeling of the, a meaning for life. There was still so much of a self-involvement with my early meditations, wanting to attain jhanas, or concentrated states, wanting peace and quiet, wanting to get rid of negativity and bad thoughts, wanting purity and feeling guilty about impurity. And so the beginning, of course, the way that I, as we all do, when we haven't had insight yet, we operate from the self-view. I've got to get something. I'm incomplete. I'm not good enough. I'm screwed up, in other words. And I need to practice meditation and maybe devote my whole life to Buddhist monasticism in order to purify myself, to hopefully become enlightened before I die. But that whole scenario is based on the sense of a permanent self, of me as a permanent kind of person that has to get something I don't have yet. And what I do have is, I'm critical of, so I want to get rid of all the bad stuff, the negative stuff, and try to make myself into a pure person, a really good person, a compassionate person, an enlightened person. And that's where, you know, so many people, you know, we start with that illusion. The self-illusion is the basic problem that we all have, the cause of suffering, never seeing through it, but operating. How many of you still operate from the self-illusion in this monastery? You know, where you're your own views, your own opinions, the sense of yourself, your attainments or lack of them, your ability to meditate or inability, your purity or impurity. Have you ever questioned it? Have you ever really observed what self is, or sakkaya ditti? So then the sense of I'm unenlightened, impure, trying to become enlightened. This, of course, in the Four Noble Truths is the way to investigate the sakya ditti, or the ego, or the separate sense of self. So that's why I encourage you all during this winter's retreat to really listen to the ego, to what you think and feel, to pay attention, an uncritical attention, a kind of receptive welcoming of your own ego, your fears, desires, frustrations, disappointments, disillusionments. To listen, to be the listener, the observer, and of the self, because this is the only way you'll understand it. You're just trying to make yourself into a better person. Even if you become a better person, you still are going to suffer because you haven't cracked the illusion. You're still operating from the illusion of self. Now, I've given many talks on this, but this is very important, because if you don't, you know, I've seen how difficult it is to really trust yourself to observe, because this basic lack of trust, lack of saddha or faith. You might have a lot of belief and hopes in Buddhism or, you know, in meditation, but that still can be operating from a sense of self. You know, my faith, my belief, my inspiration. Now, I'm not condemning that. It's not wrong. And I'm not putting it in terms of right or wrong, but pointing it out to be the knower, the observer, rather than the owner of the self. Now, to create yourself, you have to think about it. You have to believe that your thoughts are yours and your memories are what you are. That you are this person, this body, this being, this type, this personality, and so forth. That this is really me and mine, and this is the real world. My feelings, my body, myself, my life. Now, just when I say that, listening to this sense of myself, those are words, aren't they? I have to think myself, my body, my feelings, my thoughts, my memories. And so that's where this sense of observing yourself thinking, observing the thought process, is non-thinking. And that's why this listening to yourself thinking, but not with any hope of getting anything out, but just being a witness to it. Trust this awareness to the point where you listen to your thoughts, your emotional habits, but you're observing them in terms of Dhamma. All conditions are impermanent. The self that does arise, the sense of me and mine, arises and ceases, that has no sustainability. It's unreal. We just believe we are the same person from the time we were born to the present moment. Am I the same person that went to Sabha in 1964 and then went back in 2007? Was I the same person? You know, I have memories of, you know, I carried memories from 44 years ago with me to Semporna. But they were memories. There was actually no self in it. It was a memory of Semporna in 1964. And now I'm sitting here at Amaravati thinking about Semporna, remembering that's a memory. Now, that which seeing memory as memory is like investigating Dhamma. This is the way it is. All conditions are impermanent. Sanya Kanda, the memory, being able to remember. That memory is something that comes and goes. I don't sit around all day long with the same memory of Semporna. It comes and goes according to the conditions. So right now, the conditions for remembering Semporna are present, so I'm talking about. And so this is the way of reflecting on the way it is, you know, to be able to put into perspective the conditioned realm, the conditions, the physical body, the sensory conscious realities that we're experiencing, the thinking process, the emotional habits, the memories, the feelings, pleasure, pain, all of that are seen in this category of five khandhas, and that's a convenient way of observing. It's not meant to be anything but an expedient means for putting into some easy context our ability to witness all conditioned phenomena in these five categories. Now that which is aware of the five khandhas, and so this is where words fail. That's why I can't say what it is. It has no name. It has no quality, quantity, but it's reality, isn't it? Mindfulness brings you to the present, to pure consciousness, pure awareness, before you create yourself, where memories arise and cease, where emotions, of love and hate arise and cease, thoughts come and go. And so in this, there's an important emphasis that I'm making now is in this relationship of the unconditioned to the conditioned. So awareness, mindfulness is that is the reality of the unconditioned. It's a fact. It's not a memory. It's not a creation. It's not created out of ignorance. It's nothing to do with me and what I like or prefer or dislike. It's not about metaphysical thoughts or philosophy or even about religion. It's real. This awareness is the reality that we're experiencing now. This is the unconditioned. Then our relationship to the conditioned is knowing it, the conditioned as the conditioned. Discerning, the unconditioned is this, and the conditions then come and go according to other conditions. Samporna arises and ceases accordingly to, the suggestion, the memories, the people, or Ajahn Sumedho, or whatever, that arises and ceases according to certain conditions. But when the conditions for Ajahn Sumedho doesn't mean that I'm Ajahn Sumedho 24 hours a day. It's just a convention. The reality is the awareness, and then the convention arises and ceases. Now this is where it's difficult to explain, because you can't define reality. You can't find it as an object. There's no way you can say, oh, this is reality, and then point to it. Because you are the reality. This is the reality of now, awakened attention, non-grasping of any condition, discerning, seeing. Then the conditions, whatever they might be, pleasant or unpleasant, they come and go accordingly. According to our karma, according to the weather, according to the time of day, all kinds of other things affect our emotional life. That we have no control over. How can you control the weather so that you have sunny weather all the time, or, have a happy feeling in your mind all the time? When conditions for unhappiness are present, this is what one feels. Sadness, grief, like we've also, the past several months, with the death of Tanjokun Panyananda, of the Somdet Papinang, the king's sister, Princess Kalyani, who came here and opened this temple in 1999. And then Louis Fussell, who was a good friend, from Bedford, was a kind of unique, eccentric character that made violins and rode bicycles and had a black belt in karate, and he's kind of an incredible genius. Wrote symphonies and raised funds by bicycling from Land's End to John of Groats and things like that, at over 80. He was hit by a car at night riding his bicycle. I have very pleasant memories of Louis Fussell because he is some very endearing kind of person. But he's dead. So that death, you know, it always leaves one with this. When I heard of Louis Fussell is dead, I didn't feel indifferent. It doesn't matter, everything's impermanent. That's a dismissal of reality, isn't it? That's an intellectual game one plays with the mind. When you hear of the death of a loved one, or that you feel like this, this is what you feel. Jody Higgs died the other day, another good friend. So, well, everybody's got to die. What is that when I say, everybody's got to die? Don't make a scene about it. Or when you actually hear that somebody you know, somebody you like dies, this is what you feel. Now, what is it that knows that feeling? Knows the feeling of sadness or grief is like this. Then we can say, I feel grief and sad. If I was really mindful, I shouldn't suffer. Because we see grief and sadness as suffering. We think, you know, if we're really mindful, we'd never feel anything. Now you hear, Louis Fussell died, Jody Higgs died, I don't feel anything. I'm mindful. Or maybe you're just dismissing. You don't really observing what you're feeling. Maybe you didn't like them. Or you didn't know them, so they're just like any other names of people you don't know. But the awareness, the observer, that's the bhutto, the awareness, pure conscious awareness, is not created out of ignorance, is non-personal, is not dependent on idyllic conditions to make you feel peaceful or happy or whatever. It's like this, when somebody you love dies, it's like this feeling. And so in that, I'm aware, receiving this feeling. I'm not trying to indulge in it or make it into something more or dismiss it, but receive it. So this unconditioned reality is a receptacle for everything. Everything belongs. You know, there's nothing that doesn't belong in your life, whatever it might be. This realm we live in is like this. We have ideals of how it should be, so we get upset by the fact that people are murdering each other and doing all kinds of dreadful things. But everything belongs, all conditions. Because it's not that we like or approve, but because that's the way it is. All conditions are impermanent and non-self. Now if you really trust in that reflection, then you begin to see non-suffering, recognize, realize non-suffering. It doesn't mean you don't feel anything or you're totally indifferent to the unfairness, injustice, or badness of the world around you. But you're not creating it into something more than what it is. We can cope with pain, with loss, with grief, with all kinds of negative states, if we understand it in terms of Dhamma, if we have this trust, this surrender, this total faith in the awareness of the moment, the unconditioned, the unborn, uncreated, Nibbana, Anatta, and it's recognizable. It's real, it's reality. And in this reality, then the conditions, according to other conditions, arise and cease. And our relationship to those conditions then is not approving or disapproving anymore, but of recognizing and discerning. Then you might think, whenever I talk like this, I always feel that somebody's going to come up and say, well, what if, you know, we're supposed to just accept evil in the world and unfairness? And I'm not saying that. Because I'm not saying, you know, that, you know, we do good and refrain from doing the bad. You know, within the perspective of one human existence, this individual being here, you know, whatever arises and ceases, then the discerning ability, if it's good, compassionate, kind, then that's my active, how I intend to act and relate to the world. And when the aversion, negativity, hatred, resentment, fear, anger arise, I accept that equally, but I don't act on it. So there's like the sila, isn't it? It's about action and speech. And the wisdom is discerning, knowing the difference. It's not prescribed right or wrong according to cultural attitudes or preferences. It's intuitive to do what is right, act on what is right, and not to do what is wrong. But right and wrong are not absolute. They're relative to conditions, to other conditions. So that's where in monastic life we have this monastic code, the Vinaya, and the 8 precepts, 10 precepts, 5 precepts. All these are expedient means for developing, cultivating awareness. They're meant to help us to see, to give perspective on how to live in the world and still not be lost in it, deluded, overwhelmed, despairing because the world isn't what it should be or what we would like it to be. Even when the world is what we like it to be, we can't keep it that way, isn't it? You can't. When you're having a peak moment where everything is just what you want, and we have those kind of moments, you can't sustain them. They're unsustainable. That which it sustains itself then is awareness, as you begin to trust it. And then it's self-sustaining. You don't have to create it. You just recognize it. When I forget and get carried away with events or emotional habits or thoughts, I've trained myself to remember, to recognize this is reality. These thoughts are not real. These emotions I'm having now, they are what they are, but don't create them into something more than that. So in that state of receptivity, it's also metta practice. Metta or loving kindness is not, it receives everything equally, good or bad. Love or hate, right or wrong. So metta, the reality of metta is awareness. Awareness and metta, they go together. It's maybe emphasizing slightly different. With metta, you have it's more positive concept, like loving kindness. Maybe it's more inspiring. But it's not sentimentality. It's not being foolishly idealistic about everything. It's not saying we must love everybody equally. And all that, that's getting, you know, that's asking the impossible. That's an ideal. But the reality of metta is the realness, what's real of metta is our ability to rest in the unconditioned awareness where the conditions can arise and cease accordingly, without us trying to control, resist, try to keep or get rid of anything. So the of the Brahmaviharas, Upeka is the fourth one. Equanimity, or Ekagata. And this also is with awareness. When there's nothing happening, then there's Upeka, equanimity. But then when Vipaka Karma, resultant karma of our lives arises, and certain things happen, and we have certain strong emotional reactions, then we need the metta, the ability to receive and accept what we're feeling uncritically. So even if what we're feeling is selfish and mean and nasty, it's still received. Don't even label it as selfish, mean and nasty. It's like this. You see what I mean? If I have nasty feelings, if I say they're nasty, then I'm making it into, I'm giving it something. Just the word nasty makes it into something really more than what it is in the present. So this is where this awareness is the only way we can receive equally all the whole conditioned realm as we experience it. Now, like a lot of people, we're from a culture that's very controlling. You know, we're taught and conditioned to control things and to resist. And from my own background, cultural background, social background, it's all about controlling things and resisting. And so this is how I'm culturally programmed through the American kind of white middle class Protestant American cultural conditioning. Aware of that, it's a conditioning process that comes from our social conditioning, cultural conditioning, where the liberation is not through conditioning, but through the unconditioned. Then the unconditioned welcomes everything. It has no preferences. So contemplate that, the unconditioned awareness. I told somebody who the other day was advising somebody was having problems around, because they do want to control things, and how can they get rid of bad thoughts and anger and fear and all this, and how can they conquer all these frightening negative problems they have. And so I suggested welcoming them. Now, how does that affect you? You know, welcome to me doesn't mean approving. It's not. It's an attitude of receiving everything for what it is in the moment. So even the resistance or the fear or the denial or the whatever it is, receiving it, welcoming it. I use this welcoming practice a lot because it for me it works, because it allows me to receive and accept things I don't like and don't want in my life at all. If I don't do this, then I get back into the controlling, resisting modes that I'm so conditioned to do. Those are the reactions that come, that are kind of spontaneous, the reactive tendency. Something unpleasant comes, I want to push it away. Something I don't like, I want to get away from it. It's a feeling or emotion or worry, anxiety. There's little things in one's life. So this attitude of welcoming allows me to see things in that perspective of discerning them in terms of the way it is, what arises ceases, is not self. So welcoming is a kind of metta practice. And that you're not, it's no longer discriminating, you know, about good, bad, right, or wrong. It's welcoming good, bad, right, and wrong. Well, this is hard to understand from a black and white dualistic thinking process. So I'm not, you know, this is why it is bewildering to people, because we're conditioned to try to, you know, do the good and refrain from doing the bad, resist the devil and all the evil forces, and try to make yourself into a pure and saintly being. That's my cultural programming. I've been taught through cultural conditioning to resist evil, try to get rid of it, destroy it, and try to endlessly kind of hang on to the good. And that whole scenario, you know, it's in the worldly life, you know, it's praiseworthy to do good and try to improve and make everything better and try to, you know, control the evil force, not let them take over and try to punish them or destroy them, you know, pesticides, get rid of the pests, get rid of the enemy. And we can justify atrocity now. Even the United States can justify torture, because you're torturing somebody for the benefit of the rest. There's a kind of logic there, isn't it? You're torturing somebody to get the information you want so that they won't hurt or harm your side. And so that's understandable from the self-view and the cultural conditioning. But from the point of Dhamma, What happens when we're caught in this dualistic war is it just perpetuates itself, isn't it? The world right now is at a point where, you know, anything could happen with nuclear weapons and biological, chemical warfare, and there's all the endless threats to the world's population, the hatred and anger, the willingness to harm and destroy, mutilate and torture for the sake of righteousness, for getting rid of the evil forces or the enemy. So just on that level, is there any possibility in our lives? You know, it just seems to get worse and worse, you know, rather than better and better. So the antidote then, the way out of this dilemma of dualism, is through this awareness. Because then you're actually awakening to reality rather than operating from the conditioned perspective. Everybody, most human beings, are operating from their conditioning. That's why they do what they do. You know, their prejudices, their biases, their resentments, all this is from ignorance, not understanding reality, not knowing the Dhamma, being conditioned to hate the enemy, to see somebody else as your enemy, identity with your own group, tribalism, religious sectarianism, the whole lot. It's all about ignorance and self-view, attachment, and then the suffering that results from that. You can trace all the suffering, the misery of this world, and all the political problems, social, economic problems, due to this ignorance, attachment, and the result is dukkha. And this is like studying Paticca-samuppada, the dependent origination. You can see how could it be otherwise? How can there be liberation through ignorance? How can there be peace when you don't even know what it is? When you're conditioned to only fight and have wars, internal wars, prejudices, biases, attachments, strong views, resentments, opinions. So really contemplate that, to see, it's not an eradication of conditions, but understanding, seen in perspective, knowing the way it is. So then you get back to this basic teaching. All conditions are impermanent. All Dhamma is not self. Sape sankharani cha sape tama anatta. There is the unborn. Ati bhikkhave ajatang. That's a statement. The Buddha is saying, bhikkhus, there is the unborn, the uncreated. Now that's a statement of fact. It's not metaphysical speculation. It's not theoretical. It's a statement of reality. There is the escape from the born or the created, because there is the unborn, uncreated. What is that for you at this very moment? What is the unborn, uncreated, the reality of now? So it's like waking, recognizing, knowing. And you can't know it through attachment to any view or opinion. Whether you consider it Buddhist or whatever, it doesn't make any difference. Even attachment to Buddhism is an obstruction. So, I'll leave you with this to contemplate this winter's retreat. Encouragement. And to remind you, because we do forget, the world does impinge on us. It does make us frightened. We do have strong emotional reactions to events. That's the conditioning of the mind. You know, we all have programmed, all conditioned in our various ways. You know, that's just, you know, we're living together in this community. We all have our own programs, our own conditioning. You know, so don't expect anyone to be the biggest, the mistakes I've made is thinking everybody should be like me. That's really conceited, isn't it? That you should all be like me. But we have to learn from the way we are, you know, from the conditioning that we're experiencing. But we're looking at it from this perspective of Bhutto, of Buddha, knowing Dhamma, rather than from this American monk knowing the Thai forest tradition, or Theravada Buddhism, or this old man, from the ancient generation, doesn't understand the basic problems of modern life, lived away in the monasteries all these years, not up to date on the latest issues, social issues and problems of society, or whatever. It doesn't matter the generation, the gender, the convention. It's to the point of this whole life then is awakened awareness, enlightenment, seeing things in the light, in the true light of the way they are. And this paradigm of the unconditioned to the conditioned, really explore that. To me now, the unconditioned is reality. It's not something I'm looking for, or that I haven't found yet, or that it's so kind of precious that I can only get it if I under controlled conditions. It's recognized. It's reality. And then the relationship to the conditioned is from there, rather than from me trying to become enlightened or me trying to find the unconditioned. If I'm operating from me trying to find the unconditioned, I can't do it. My ego cannot ever find the unconditioned. It's just a matter of awakening to it, recognizing. It's very simple, very direct. So I offer this for your reflection.